This podcast is brought to you by The Province.
Listening to the DGP with province writer Dana G.
Hi, welcome to the DGP with me, Dana G. Today's episode is a really interesting interview, if I don't say so myself. No, it's interesting because the woman I'm speaking with is Stevie Phillips. She's a one-time super agent. When I mean super agent, like agent to some really, really big name stars. She's written a memoir called Judy, Liza, Robert, Freddie, David, Sue, and Me. Now, while that title is for sure cumbersome, the book itself is a fantastic read, a real page-turner. And you don't even have to actually be a fan of Hollywood type stories. You just need to be a fan of good stories. And what you'll find interesting about this is Stevie Phillips's job before she became a super agent, as they're called. One of her very first jobs as a young adult, I think she's like 21, she was hired to be minder to Judy Garland. Now, anybody who knows anything about Judy Garland knows that's got to have to have been a tough job. And you find that out in this book, and you actually find out stories that I know I've never heard before about Judy, so that's kind of interesting. She also talks about her relationship with Judy's daughter, Liza, and there's the burning question of who's hotter, Robert Redford or Paul Newman. Just a really, really great read, so we'll be talking with Stevie in a little bit. Also on the show, Jim Gordon from CTV is here for movies, and an interesting array this week. Tom Cruise is back with yet another Mission Impossible. It's like number 5 now. And yes, in case you haven't found out, he does do his own stunts. I don't know why he always has to tell us that, but he does. The other film on there is a small creepy thriller called The Gift, and a really great documentary about the relationship between William F. Buckley and Gore Vidal called The Best of Enemies. But let's get the show started with my chat with Stevie Phillips. So Stevie Phillips is on the line with us this morning. Stevie, thanks so much for joining us.
It's lovely to be here. Thank you for calling.
So your book is a page-turner. It was a great read. I have to ask you now, though, and after all your long years in the business and all the experiences, why do the book now? What made you finally decide that it was the time to do it?
I don't know. You need an awful lot of perspective. I started the book a number of times. It took a number of different forms. I knew that I wanted to write about alcoholism. I knew I wanted to write about addiction. And it's not easy to do. I had to think about it a great deal.
Yeah, I can imagine. And we're referring to that, obviously, the stepping off point for both of those things for you and in the book is the great Judy Garland and your relationship with that. For people who haven't read the book, we could just maybe back it up a little bit. If you could explain to people how you came to be such a big part of her life and vice versa.
Well, I was working for two very, very talented businessmen who had just left Music Corporation of America when there were practices that shut them down. They started their own business, and they needed a star to put them on the map. And they decided that that star was Judy Garland, who was just vegging out in a walk-up flat in London. And they thought that if they could bring her back for a comeback, it would put their company on the map. She was easily talked into that, told by my mentor and boss, Freddie Fields, that for each pound she lost, he would get her a motion picture. She came to New York, and some contracts needed to be signed. I was sent around the corner to the hotel she was staying in, and she and I had a giggle together. And she made up her mind that life would be a little bit better on the road if I was there with her. And she asked my two bosses, the good one and the bad one, whether or not I could come along. And since they knew me not well at all, they were delighted to sacrifice me if that's what it would take.
And they absolutely knew what they were, what sort of lion's den they were sending you in, because this was Judy Garland at a point where her career had, you know, not rock bottom, but it was in quite a lull, and she needed a win, didn't she? She needed a comeback.
She needed a comeback desperately, and I needed an opportunity desperately. So those two things merged at the right time. However, they had no idea how much trouble that she would be. They thought that if they got her what she needed, she would be indebted and grateful and a pleasure to work with. But addiction takes a foothold in the most horrible ways, and her behavior was an outgrowth of that. And it was truly sad because she was, as you said when you first introduced the subject, one of the greatest. She was one of the best entertainers that America ever produced.
It's interesting, you know, when as I was reading your book and thoroughly enjoying it, the Judy Garland stuff, that I thought I knew a lot of the stuff about her. You know, there's the famous stories. There's the, you know, getting drugs while she was doing The Wizard of Oz, all those things. And, you know, and having seen clips of her in shows, and it's so obviously that she was under the influence or something. But your stories were, you know, stopped me in my tracks. And I can't even imagine as a woman, you know, young woman, too, you're in your early 20s, managing this hurricane of talent, but also just sheer madness. When you think of Judy, what out of all those times and those incidents, what's the first story that comes to your mind as the one where you even think, holy moly?
Being able to handle the events that took place, which were just awful, persuaded me that I had the coping skills to be able to endure and control the situations and save her life if necessary, except when we were at sea. And then it was completely out of my hands. I was certain that the boat we were on was going to be swamped, that we were going down, and that I was thinking about, at that moment, my last moments, the last moments that I would have. And when I think back on it today, I think the same thing. Everything else was controllable. This was not. It was out of my hands.
And this was supposed to be a nice break and a vacation, and you were expected you were going to go out on some lovely luxury yacht, but you ended up in kind of an old scow with some nefarious characters, didn't you?
It was, it looked like a Viking ship. Either that or a prop out of an old Errol Flynn movie, if anybody remembers that. Sadly, I do. Well, I shouldn't say sadly. No. I'm grateful to be in good health at this age. But I remember the only thing that this boat was missing were the cannon. If there were cannon coming out of the portholes, it would have fulfilled the role of a pirate ship. I mean, it was just a disaster. It was a disaster to look at, and worse, it was a disaster to be on.
Yeah, and you're on with someone who was a disaster herself. When you...
It was just a terrible, terrible trip. It was a nightmare from start to finish.
When reading the stuff about Judy and obviously the addiction and the alcoholism and just the, you know, the spoiled nature, like the nature of a star like that, the thing that resonated with me as well is just her need to have men accept her, the constant need and the bad choices that were made from that.
That's right on, Dana. There was in Judy a center that was missing. There was like an emptiness in the center of her universe, in the center of her body, that could not be filled by the adoration of the audience. Night after night, they loved her as much as they could, and it didn't fill up this emptiness. It needed to be a man. And the men that she picked were pigs.
Yeah, she just wanted to be treated poorly, didn't she? It's just one of the saddest things I've read, because being a big fan, I think anybody that's ever saw her, you know, even a minute of her performing live, realizes the power and the talent, and then to have that film as, you know, I mean, it's one of the greatest ever made. I felt so heartbroken for her. And then I also kind of felt heartbroken for you, see, at such a, you know, a young age. And this is what you're seeing and having to manage. I felt like maybe some of the joy you might have wanted to go into this business for was kind of snatched away from you just out of, you know, self-preservation.
You were wasting your pity on me.
Okay.
I was going through an incredible moment in my life, and I recognized it. I thought to myself, no one has ever been here. The biographers who wrote about Judy, they were not there. I was there. And I understood that this was a make-or-break time for me, that if I managed to come out the other side whole, that I could demand what I wanted for myself. And it turned out that way.
Yeah, I guess so. And I mean, the ultimate baptism of fire, too, out of the blocks. I mean, you didn't get a chance to build up towards
for sure.
that, did you? And what did you take away from that experience, like moving forward? You know, not just the ability to hold or juggle a lot of things and to manage things to save a life at the same time as making sure the dry cleaning was there. What sort of really deep things that did you walk away from that experience with Judy with or not?
Well, I learned what yes really meant, and I learned how to say no.
Mm-hmm.
Those were two things that were very, very important in my career ongoing. I learned how to be tough, and I learned that being tough went along with being kind, or you didn't like yourself when you looked in the mirror.
Right.
I took away so many things that have been of value in my lifetime.
Right. Where were you when you found out that Judy had passed away?
In my apartment across the street.
Right.
Across the street from the funeral home where she was given a memorial service. And I could not go in, Dana. I could not. I watched the lines around the block. I went and I sat in Central Park. I thought about it a lot, and I could not go back. I've dealt with that in a short chapter that I wrote called Sometimes. Mm. Sometimes anything involved with her is easy, easy to see, easy to remember, easy to look at, and sometimes it's just virtually impossible.
With all this stuff that we know about her, you know, away from the stage and the marriages and stuff, what she's still so revered and just, you know, heads and shoulders above so many other entertainers. What is it is about us as fans, or that we forgive all of that?
Well, the thing is that she is the icon of our childhood, many of us, and we want to preserve all of that. It's pure, it's innocent, it's beautiful, it's trusting. So there are people that want to remember her as Dorothy from Kansas. And for them, this should never change. And there are many of those people that are savaging me on Facebook.
Really?
Oh, for sure. My publisher's Facebook, I'm of a different generation. I had to be talked into doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But I have found it really a terrific thing. I mean, apart from it being a marketing tool, that's the least of it. I've become acquainted with people that I forgot about 35 or 40 years ago that I'm delighted to meet again, that I'm delighted to remember. But it's also been an opportunity for many who want their Dorothy back to try and turn me into the Wicked Witch from the West.
You know, I bet you half of those people that are commenting on the site haven't even read the book, because I was a huge Judy Garland fan. I read the book, devoured the book, and I didn't think that there was any moment in that that you were, you know, selling this to her way, you are using her and her misfortunes and stuff. It was just a chronicle. And it was, if anything, I was glad to have read that and to see the side of her, as we mentioned earlier, to see the side of this poor, sad woman and the need for acceptance from men in any shape and form. I think it's more interesting than
that. Well, you're right. Most of them have not read the book. And in those responses that I get that are awful but leave a little hole for explanation, I try to answer. And in the end, some of them have read the book and gotten back to me and said that they were glad that they did. What I have tried to do is make her real. My life was real. What happened to me was real. This book is about my life and the impact that she and others had on it, that their addiction had on it. And in the process, I hope that I've given her the humanity that she deserves to have.
Well,
I mean, there is no arguing with the fact that she was brilliant. Her voice was liquid magic. She could wrap it around any notes. She sang with such empathy and with such understanding. She moved the audience. She was not one of a kind, but still a rarity. And she was marvelous. And she was a whole person. And that's the person I've tried to show you.
Well, I think you've completely succeeded with that. I mean, real is the best way to put it. And then from moving forward in the book, you end up managing her daughter, Liza. Just to, before we get into that, I just want to know, has Liza read the book and was there a response to you at all?
The answer is, I don't know. I know that there is a story waiting to happen if Liza takes umbrage with the book.
Mm-hmm.
But my guess is that if she is smart, this is my editorializing, she will say nothing because Liza knows that I speak the truth.
Right. Well, there's no point in it. And again, with her, you present what happened and what happened to you in that relationship. And I don't think that there's a chance that anybody should or could complain about that because that's your reality and your truth. I'm just wondering, you know, from an emotional standpoint, when you were in the midst of that, if you ever, as you were starting your relationship with Liza, having gone through that relationship with her mother, and obviously a lot of similarities between the two, just from a talent standpoint, if you ever sort of put on the brakes and thought, you know what, I could see this movie again, it might happen again.
No. First of all, when I met Liza at 13, she was so sweet, so kind, so really she was a lovely young woman. When I started getting her jobs, everybody spoke about how nice she was to work with, how cooperative. They were enchanted by her. So it was a number of years before the bad things started to happen. And when they started to happen, Judy was long gone. I had been inured by wonderful years with Liza, and I wasn't about to give up as we were on the precipice of the most extraordinary things happening for her.
Right. How did you deal with hangers-on? I don't know why that just popped into my mind. I guess I'm thinking of the Liza stuff, and you sort of see those glamorous photos of the Studio 54 and the entourages and the. Did you have a standard practice of how to clear a room or how to take care of things like that?
There were some things that were not as important as others. The entourage simply wasn't as important. I mean, there were nights after a concert when we got on the planes that I had chartered that were deadheading back to where they came from, where the plane was filled with some freaky faces. And I thought to myself, I can stop this right now, but how does this really impact going forward tomorrow's concert? And the answer was, it didn't. And so having to prioritize freaky faces were okay for a night. But there did come a time, Dana, when the party started, say, on a Thursday at 3 in the afternoon, and 2 months later it was still going on.
God.
And I would say to myself, enough, mm-hmm. you know, and I would say to Liza, enough.
Mm-hmm.
But that didn't stop the growth of her addiction, nor some of the people who filled up the slots in her emptiness.
Yeah, I guess, you know, there's a genetic component to that as well. Stevie, moving forward from, you know, these two powerful women and such icons and stuff, I mean, the rest of your list of clients and people you worked with is equally as staggering. I mean, a young Robert Redford and Paul Newman, holy moly. That wasn't a bad day. That's not a bad day at the office taking those meetings, I bet. And then from there...
No, it was not a bad day at the office. I mean, I had some thrilling times. Riding horseback all over the mountains with Robert Redford is not hard work.
No kidding. Quit showing off. But then you move... you've got, you know, Henry Fonda, the great director George Roy Hill, Bob Fosse, and their Cat Stevens, David Bowie. I mean, your client list was also, I mean, must have been so exciting to have all these different experiences with such different talents. You could see, you know, if you just stuck with a Broadway stars or you just stuck with that, but you really covered the map in show business.
Well, I was very fortunate, but fortunate doesn't come without an awful lot of hard work, without a lot of pounding the pavement, without a lot of pitches, without a lot of research, without a lot of really just grinding.
Mm-hmm.
And one doesn't stop to be excited because one is working so hard that you forget to take a moment and say to yourself, oh, well, I'll just go on vacation now and think about how fortunate I am while I'm skiing. Doesn't happen that way.
Well, okay, now looking back, I'm going to ask you, this is just a very self-serving question, but Robert Redford and Paul Newman back in the day, who was prettier?
Oh, boy.
Come on. I guess.
It's very, very hard, Dan. I mean, one could get lost in Paul Newman's blue eyes. On the other hand, when Robert Redford smiled, the world was a better place.
That's so great, though. But, you know, you look at that. It was funny. A Cat on a Hot Tin Roof was just replayed on TV the other day. And I just thought, oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. But looking at that.
And they were both such lovely guys. It made going to the office a wonderful time, even though one could get staggered by a negotiation. At the end of the day, it was what I grew up wanting to do.
Did you, you know, you're in this position and you have such a diverse client base. I'm just wondering, looking back, if you could share a story with us where there was a fire that you had to put out, what was sort of one of the toughest ones that you've ever encountered, and maybe share that with us as an agent, as somebody in the middle of it. Can you give us a story about having to put out a big fire?
The biggest fire that I ever had to put out was how my life crumbled finally, not because of my clients, but because I had been an enabler, because I had been taking care of people and doing their housekeeping for so long that it finally got to me when I discovered that my last husband had interchangeable addictions. And I fell apart. And mm-hmm. for me, that was an enormous fight to be able to find myself again, to reclaim the person that I am, tough, organized, I hope, kind, knowing, decently intelligent, was hard work. And it took me 5 years in Al-Anon and a lot of therapy to find myself again. But the message in that is that it's possible.
Mm-hmm.
You can be the person you want to be.
You must have been, your first couple meetings at Al-Anon, the rest of the people at the meeting groups must have been floored. I mean, and I'm not trying to make light of this, but I mean, your level of enabling and vision or sights that you've seen with people with addictions isn't the run of the mill stuff.
Well, I was not anxious to give up my clients.
Mm-hmm.
I did an awful lot of listening in Al-Anon, and I spoke when I could speak without really telling the stories that you've now called a page turner.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't seem to me to be right. It wasn't decent. I didn't want to do that, and I didn't want to attract attention for all the name-dropping that I knew that I could do and no one else could do. That's not what it was about. For me, it was about takeaway, mm-hmm. and the takeaway was enormous.
Looking back at what you did for all those years and all those different clients and all the different contracts you saw or pushed through, I'm just wondering for you, what was the best part of the deal for you when you got in there? What really lit you up?
The best present that I ever got? Well, there are many gifts. There were many gifts. The best present I ever got was from Redford. He gave me the West. I put that in the book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he turned me on to skiing. He turned me on to hiking, as you read. Ultimately, I climbed Kilimanjaro, thinking if I can do that at 60, I can stay in the business.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing can get me down. The other gift that I got was producing on Broadway, to stand off to the side behind a curtain and watch an audience howl with laughter or enjoy themselves so much, to walk through the crowd at intermission and listen to people that are enjoying what is the product of a tough collaboration and having a wonderful time is such a gift. I think of those things with such joy now, the joy that I'm getting from the feedback of those people who are reading my book. Those are great gifts.
You were at one point headed up the motion picture departments at CMA now I guess it's ICM, but you started out with on the live side of things with Judy Garland, and you ended up in the end in Broadway. A New York kid through and through, is the live theater experience the one for you?
The live theater experience was incredible in my life, but Broadway has changed a great deal. And so now the live theater experience is not the same as it was. It's not something that I want to repeat. There are people who repeat the same thing for years and years and years and years, their whole lives until they retire. But the idea of being able to look down the road 10 years and see myself doing the same thing is nothing that has ever interested me. So I'm moving on in a way that has amazed me as much as anything can. I've just invented a product.
It sounds like that's what's in your DNA, though, is to move forward and shift. I mean, you're kind of... like mercury, you're liquid. That's the sense I got from this. I mean, that would probably be why you survived all these experiences, that you're able to keep moving.
That is perhaps true. There are people who absorb those experiences so much that they cannot move on. They get stuck.
Right.
Stuck is not a nice word in my vocabulary. It's a dirty word.
What do you think about the business today, the Hollywood we see today with the social media? Everybody's got 15 publicists around them. Everybody's got 100 lawyers around them. How do you look at it?
I think to myself that it hasn't changed but for the technology. We hear, because of the technology, because there are no secrets, about people that are going in and out of rehab like walking through a revolving door. They just keep going round and round. There are still addicts. There are still people whose behavior is difficult. There are still people who think that they can run rampant over others. As far as I'm concerned, there is nothing different except that we know more, we're able to see more, do more, and all because of the technology. But it does not change personalities.
Right. Yeah, I guess that we, once you're in there, you're in there. I have to ask you, Stevie, before I let you go today, you know the whole idea of the mythical dinner party, people alive or passed on? I'm just wondering if you could give me two or three people that you would love to sit down and have dinner with.
Well, certainly Redford would be there, Newman would be there, George Roy Hill would be there, and then I would want to put Judy Garland at the same table, because that's like putting apples and oranges together, or pigs and elephants, and then sparks fly, and you have to see what's going to happen. There's excitement in that.
That's it. See, even after all those things that you went through, you still have a bit of a craving for that excitement and that drama, or that you're not sure what's around the corner.
There's no question about it. I mean, I want to have a good time. I want to be excited by the things that I do, by the people that I meet. That's never going to change. Never. I mean, as long as I can take a breath, I'm going to make life interesting for myself and, if possible, for those around me.
How do you feel now with this book, and now we're all starting to talk about it, that now you're at the center of a story? You were always the one helping along the other people with their stories and putting them in the spotlight. Was there any moments of trepidation about when you realized, uh-oh, people are going to want to ask me about me?
No, I'm ready to talk about it now. But years ago, this book has no pictures in it. And the reason it has no pictures is anytime a photographer came along, I ran. I ran in the other direction. I thought to myself, this is about my client. It's not about me. Get out of here.
Right.
So it's odd for me to be in the center. I don't shrink from it, but I don't embrace it either. I think to myself, okay, I'll answer the questions that I'm asked. But I try to stay on the sidelines, because you can see a whole lot more when you're not being observed.
That's a good one. Well, congratulations on the book. It was a great read, an interesting read, a fun read. You hit a whole bunch of emotions in that one. I thought it was quite fascinating. And it was a page-turner.
Well, I'm so delighted to have you say those things. It's very gratifying for me. I couldn't have enjoyed talking to you more. Thank you so much for wanting to talk to me.
And no problem. And remember, those people on Facebook, those haters, don't worry about them. If they haven't read the book, they don't have the right to complain.
Well, I tell you, Dana, I'm glad they're worrying about me.
You know, right? You're absolutely right. The worst part is when they're not talking about you, right?
You betcha.
All right. Thank you so much, Stevie.
Pleasure to talk to you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Syndicate is real. A rogue nation trained to do what we do.
An anti-IMF.
Ready or not, here I come.
They're coming after us with everything they've got.
You ready?
This may very well be our last mission. Let's make it count.
So what's the play?
You want to bring down the Syndicate? It's impossible.
Alrighty, that was a clip from the soon-to-be mega blockbuster, I guess, Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. It's the fifth in the installment. Before we get started, and I welcome my guest, my regular guest, Jim Gordon, just want to remind people, just before we tape this movie review segment for the DGP podcast, we do Periscope Live. And if you don't know what Periscope is, well, come on, kids, get with it. You can follow us, and the best way to do it is follow us on Periscope at Province Podcast. If you do that, then you'll get a notification that when we're coming up live, and you can actually talk directly with Jim and I. Today we had like someone from Belize, Austria,
Amsterdam,
Timbuktu,
Istanbul,
which was once Constantinople.
Wow, look at you.
I just know that song. My dad always sang that song. Okay, enough dilly-dallying about. Jim Gordon, welcome.
Mm-hmm, thank you.
So let's kick things off. Let's kick it old school, because the first Mission Impossible movie, I believe, came out 19 years ago.
Yeah, 96.
When I was just a wee, wee child.
You were 15 at the time?
Yeah, about that. Thank you. You can come back next week. So Mission Impossible, Rogue Nation, what do we think? I think I liked it a lot.
You and I are a tough Tom Cruise critics.
Yes,
so if you hear us saying, folks, that we like this, you know it's good. It's a cliche to say roller coaster ride, but it's from the opening seconds when he is hanging on to the side of that B-29 or cargo plane or whatever it is. It is really good. And it's what I said. You and I always say a couple things we don't like. Too long, too much story. This is just the right time.
Yeah.
It's about
208, yeah, 210. Yeah.
And it doesn't get buried and bogged down in too much story.
No, because it's a basic good versus evil. What we've got here is the IMF, not the International Monetary Fund, which I think would be super sexy to get Christine Lagarde roaring around in a cat suit with a briefcase with a chain to her wrist. And she's carrying the money. She's trying to get it to Greece.
Great hair.
See,
great
I just wrote our hit.
That's a great
hit. Our hit movie.
Love her.
Christine Lagarde?
Yeah, love her. she kicks ass in that club.
Yeah,
she does it elegantly, and she's brilliant too.
Yeah, she's just as bad as they are. Anyways, it's not that IMF; it's some sort of spy group. It's the Tom Cruise IMF. And in this case, it's what I call. I know it goes back before this, but I like to call it Jack Bauer syndrome. When people save the world over and over again, and yet the people above them in charge want to get rid of them. I just don't. He saved the world last time, people. He's probably going to save it again. And this is the case here. So the CIA, which is headed up by a rather portly Alec Baldwin in this case. Holy moly. I thought his wife was a yoga instructor.
He lost about 40 pounds during the last season of 30 Rock, which was, what, 3-4 years ago. So,
what are we, farmers, Lemon? That's still the best line.
Still the best line. Yeah.
I know. So he's the CIA guy, and he wants to get rid of the IMF because they run rogue. Which is kind of ironic coming from the CIA, because I believe everything in the CIA is run rogue. I think that was sort of the problem. Wasn't that the biggest problem with 9/11 is that they didn't tell anybody what was going on?
I think he was getting angry that they're getting into too much of their own rogue territory.
Right.
Yeah.
And so they have to go out and either discern that if this is a real thing and then fight it is something called the Syndicate. And I won't give away what the Syndicate ends up being because it has a bit of a twist. This is not intellectual heavy lifting. This is not Jean Le Carre stuff.
No.
This is pretty, you know, by the books, fun espionage. Not even really espionage-y.
No, there's not a lot of yakking. There's
nobody with a German accent.
No, which is interesting. There's lots of, like, it just goes from location to location. Every place has its great car chase or its big fight or big things blowing up. And it really does move, and there's a lot of laughs.
I think really helps this movie. It's got a bit of an Ocean's 11 feel.
It does.
With the group of them. It's Simon Pegg. Vin Rhymes. Who else are we missing in there?
Jeremy Renner, who's not really part of them until later in the movie.
Yeah,
but
they've got chemistry, and you've got Cruise. You know, he doesn't really change from movie to movie anymore. He's got that. You know, he's always going to show us that. He's strong, he's fit, he's virile, but he'll never be taller, but that's fine. We're okay with that now, Tom. Let it go.
Yeah.
We know you can do all this stuff. I mean, he's got his shirt off. He had kind of a Bruce Lee feel at one point to me with the black pants, tight black pants, the shirt off, and then martial arts like moves. I thought, oh, he's giving us a little Bruce Lee action there.
And he did a fantastic chase scene on a motorcycle, which was all him.
Yeah.
No helmet on. I don't know how fast he was going in real life.
What's the insurance rate on a Tom Cruise movie? Can you imagine?
I fathom what he has to go through.
I bet you it's unbelievable.
Yeah. He does so many stunts in this movie, which I must say, and I don't want to criticize him for this, but it does sometimes get in the way. That's my only...
It becomes the lore.
I'm nitpicking here, but at times you could joke that it's the Tom Cruise show. I'm doing this, then I'm doing this. But regardless of that, he's back on top because he's had some stumbles lately. I love the lead actress in this movie, too, who wasn't a 19-year-old former model. She looked believable and was good in this film, the British actress. So, yeah, overall for me, 8 out of 10. Welcome back, Tom.
Yeah, I'm up with that. I'm definitely up with that, 8 out of 10. And I'm usually harsher on this stuff because I get bored with car chases. I find it just such an American default button in movies.
Yeah.
But this one, they were done quickly and... fast and just sexy and exciting, I thought.
Yeah.
And I want one of those new BMWs that apparently you can just open the car. It has a hand sensor on it.
Yeah, that was pretty
cool. Do you think those they must exist? They must be
they're
like
coming. They're coming soon. Yeah, just a hand on the windshield.
I know.
The window.
But you know what? That's going to be hard for me to do because I spent my whole childhood being raised, being told, get your hands off the dirty hands off the walls or the windows. It's tough.
You're going to have to fight that. That's I a will. Lifelong problem.
There'll be
problem.
Some therapy.
Yeah.
All right. So now we're actually kind of a huge switch in tone. We're going to go from the crazy wild world of a Mission Impossible film to a documentary called Best of Enemies. Now, let's have a listen to the clip and then we'll give it a chat.
Two of America's most eloquent commentators, William Buckley and Gore Vidal.
Bill Buckley was the first modern conservative to see that ideological debates were cultural debates.
Mr. Buckley, do you think miniskirts are in good taste?
On you, I think they are.
The people at ABC asked him, well, is there anybody you wouldn't go on with? And he said, the only one I can think of is Gore Vidal.
Gore Vidal is one of America's most successful and distinguished writers.
We are all prostitutes in one sense or another, ethically, if not sexually.
For Buckley, Vidal was the devil.
I am a happy warrior. I'm in battle. I'm enjoying it.
He represented everything that was going to moral hell.
All right, so there we go. That is Best of Enemies. And as it said in that clip, it focuses on William F. Buckley Jr., well-known conservative, ultra conservative, and Gore Vidal, the novelist and I guess historian at the end of the day, too. He wrote a lot of historical fiction and history.
Big liberal.
Big liberal. Super big, big, giant liberal. So you've got polls.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
polls here. Yeah. And so they were ABC News that set up. ABC News back in 68 for the Democratic National Convention had they were third in the ratings and they wanted to do something, but they didn't have the money to have the big anchors and have all the big guests. So they pulled in these two talking heads, I guess, for lack of a better term at the time. I mean, they're both outspoken guys, and gave them like a couple minutes at the end of each nightly news broadcast and on live television, which... good idea.
Yeah.
Well, it was a good idea for most of the time, but also some of the very interesting things came out of this was the classic line, which I think anybody knows. If you should Google it, if you don't, is at one point in the debates, Gore Vidal calls William F. Buckley a crypto Nazi, and then William F. Buckley retorts with, "Now listen here, you queer. I'm going to pop you in the nose, and you're going to go down. And you, what is it?
Stay plastered.
Stay plastered.
Yeah."
It's a fascinating. I mean, I knew a lot about these two guys going in because they have such great characters. I mean, and you can spend a day on YouTube watching clips of them with other people speaking or people speaking about them. But what I thought, aside for the two personalities, I thought was interesting that it was a really great look at the times and how all of a sudden TV became very important in the political landscape.
Yeah.
The power of television, the power of the nightly news, the power of commentators that people could actually see in their living rooms. So.
Yeah, it's ground zero for TV punditry.
Yeah, absolutely.
The difference being is that you pull whether you like their politics or not. Mm-hmm. I'm not siding with either one, although I probably would lean more with Vidal, obviously. But you bring these two mental Goliaths together to fight it out like they're in a Noel Coward movie or so. You know what I mean? Like, no, because they're so witty and intelligent. I mean, take away the politics, just their speaking and their retorts and the replies. And I don't think Buckley was prepared, but he caught up pretty quickly. And it was great that they had the Republican convention and the Democratic. Yeah. So each guy was kind of had to defend. But this is where the, you know, screaming and yelling six panel member TV garbage we see nowadays.
Yeah, the crossfire bullshit.
This is where it began. And it's unfortunate that it's become so dumb and loud and stupid.
Well, and just people just saying things to get reactions now. You know, the fact that Ann Coulter can just say stupid shit for a reaction and people listen to it because, well, the other thing is you don't see now opposing views so much anymore.
No.
People are going to watch newscasts or pundits that they already agree with, which is like the really dangerous part of it because how do you ever learn anything, right? You know, how do you learn anything if everybody agrees with you all the time? And so this part of this was great. And like I said, it was a sign of the times because there was all those strife at those conventions, all the security issues.
Yeah,
and
especially Chicago. Yeah, Democratic one.
Democratic one. Yeah. I mean, that was a total lockdown, right?
Yeah.
Protesters and stuff. And this is, you know, Vietnam, everything was going on in America at this point. This is one of the critical years of the modern America that we know, right?
Yeah.
So it's a fascinating film for that reason and for these men. And you're right. I love that term. It's a ground zero of TV punditry. Mm. And you wish you'd go back. And that's when it makes you miss guys like this or like Christopher Hitchens. You could see that he learned a lot from these guys.
Hitchens is like the son of these guys.
Yeah. And funny though, he would be kind of a blend of the both of them, right? Because his politics, although we're on the left more, but he thought it was okay to go into Iran or Iraq. I think it's a good historical moment. I think people should watch it. They should see it, and they should remember. Yeah, when discussions did mean that you don't agree with everything.
And these two guys got. I mean, I should say Buckley more than Vidal. Vidal kept his cool.
I think because he did more research,
and he was also. I think he knew what was at stake here, and he had done. A little more kind of this TV where you bat heads. They hated each other going in.
Yeah,
that's why they brought them together.
Well, that was the funny part about it is that he keeps bringing it up. William F. Buckley. He's trying to score Vidal's homosexual.
Yeah.
You know, it's the late 60s. Not everybody's running around, you know, screaming at the top of their lungs about their sexuality. But Gore Vidal wasn't afraid of it. He wrote Myra Breckinridge, for God's sakes, which is looking
modeled
back.
Modeled after Buckley, as he says in the movie.
Looking back, if, whoa, prescient, right? A man who becomes a woman who goes back to becoming a man.
Yeah,
isn't that,
yeah.
And you cast Raquel Welch, the hottest woman. Like, it's just everything about that movie or that book is perfect.
And
it upset Buckley, because he keeps going back to, he's trying to remind the Americans at the supper hour newscast that they're on that this guy's a smut peddler.
Yep.
It must be smut. Right?
The thing that really left with me is, and I hate to sound like you're getting older where you're saying, they don't make them like that anymore, but these two guys politically could not be more polar opposite, but they were both from the same cut of cloth, that they both came up high upper classes, mm-hmm. Long lineages. I mean, these guys were the same. They grew up the same, only in different parts of the left and the right. And it also, it's amazing that these encounters haunted both of them. Like Buckley kept going back, and then Vidal went back to one up him, and Vidal got the last laugh because he lived longer.
Yeah, because he lived longer. That's the thing that was, when you get to the very end of it, I guess that is because he could get the last word in.
Yeah.
And you're right, they were like dogs of the bone. They would not let this go afterwards.
Yeah.
And it's funny because you watch it, and who does win? Well, I mean, my politics want me to lean towards Vidal, but I just thought he was also better prepared. He did all his homework. I think Buckley went in thinking, it's just
gonna be
a romp.
Yeah,
I have no problem with this, you know, as he called him, queer.
Yeah.
And
which really, he struggled with that for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
That he resorted to calling Gore Vidal a slam like that.
Yeah.
It really.
Which, I mean, you know, he probably called him way worse things when he had into half a bottle of whiskey talking to Pat Buckley.
Yeah, yeah.
He probably did, right? But and that's the thing, right? Live television, and that was real live television. Yeah. And I think the line was, oh, my God, can you say that on TV? And everybody said, well, he just did.
Yeah.
But two,
as I said, they don't make them like that anymore. Two Renaissance men that just both very brilliant.
Yeah.
And you just don't see that on TV
anymore. You don't see discussion. You don't see. No. Yeah, that's true. So go, please, people, go out and support.
You can tell we liked it.
Yeah, go out and plus support independent films and smaller films. Documentaries are the best things going. So Best of Enemies, it's a thumbs up for both.
Yeah,
this week,
I was just going to say, you see as many movies as I do. We both see. There's never been a better time for documentaries.
Right.
In the last 3, 4, mm-hmm. 5 years. Huh?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think so. It's because it's, you know, everybody can make something now.
Yeah,
the technology's there. And I think more people are this is going to sound really horrible. More interesting people have died. So it's opened up the doors to tell their stories. Right.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's it for us for movies this week. And I think this is it for you and I for movies for the next few weeks, because it's summer holidays.
I know.
And I've pre-recorded a bunch of stuff, and we obviously can't do that with movies because we have embargoes from when we can review them. So you're going to be very lonely, I'm sure, without me.
Oh, I will. I feel like Johnny Carson here. I'll see you after Labor Day.
Is that what he would say?
We're taking August off, everybody.
And Adam, we'll leave Adam here. Adam, thank you so much for
Adam, thank you as
for
always,
your
sir.
Love and understanding. All right.
And don't forget, you can follow us
on Twitter. I'm Dana_G, and you are?
At JimCTVMovies.
Yeah, and also Periscope people, please go and join up with us there at Province Podcast, because you can talk to us directly next time we come back and tape.
And it's so much looser. We went from Tom Cruise to cruise ships, didn't we?
And me never cruising.
And you never cruising.
Yes.
And Dana's vacation and closet rearrangement plans.
I do see. So that's it for this week's episode of the DGP with me, Dana G. Before I go, I'd like to thank Adam Foster, the wonderful and cheerful engineer / producer / straight man. Is Adam, you're supposed to say something straight.
I like girls.
That's true. I'd also like to thank Jim Gordon from CTV for the movie reviews, and my guest Stevie Phillips. If you get a chance, go pick up her book. It's a great read. Next week, please download our show. I'm going to be talking Queer Film Festival here in Vancouver. We'll be speaking with a really, really interesting director named Marjorie Sturm, who's done this great film, this documentary called The Cult of J.T. Leroy. I don't want to give too much away, but it's kind of a story of a big fake out. It's a really great movie. So anyways, check us out there or download us, as I said. And then you can also go to theprovince.com/podcast or check us out on Stitcher, iTunes, and TuneIn. Also, please follow The Province Podcast on Periscope and watch the show live as we record it here in the studio. Okay, I guess that's about it. I think did I forget anything, Adam? We're good to go? All right, folks. Well, thanks for listening and keep it real.
You've been listening to the DGP, hosted by province writer Dana G. Follow Dana on Twitter at Dana_G or read her stories on theprovince.com. Subscribe to this and other great province podcasts by searching iTunes or clicking the links available on theprovincepodcasts.com.